It's the night of March 13th, 1919, in New Orleans, Louisiana. Normally, the vibrant city comes to life at night, but tonight is different. The people of the city are awake, but they are paralyzed with fear. They are armed, watching their doors in anticipation for an intruder. Families sleeping in shifts to stay vigilant. For almost a year, a real-life boogeyman has been terrorizing the city, breaking into homes while residents sleep and brutally attacking them with an axe. 8 men and women have fallen victim to this killer, and no one feels safe. The journalists at the local paper, Times-Picayune, have been reporting on the attacks for months now. But the murderer has yet to be identified, and the police are nowhere close to catching him. But on this night in March, as the paper gets ready to send the next day's stories to the printer, a letter sent to the office is brought to the journalist's attention. As they read the letter, a collective chill goes down their spines. Because there, in black and white, was a message from the boogeyman himself. It read, "Esteemed mortal, they have never caught me and they never will. They have never seen me, for I am invisible. Even as the ether surrounds your earth, I am not a human being, but a spirit, and a demon from the hottest hell." The letter goes on to promise more victims and taunts police's efforts to catch him. But then he offers the residents a strange deal in exchange for their safety. Now, to be exact, at 12:15 earthly time, on the next Tuesday night, I'm going to pass over New Orleans. In my infinite mercy, I'm going to make a little proposition to you people. Here it is. I am very fond of jazz music, and I swear by all the devils in the nether regions that every person shall be spared in whose home a jazz band is in full swing at the time I have just mentioned. If everyone has a jazz band going, well, then so much better for you people. One thing is certain, and that is that if some of your people do not jazz it out on that specific Tuesday night, if there be any, we'll get the axe. This is the story of the New Orleans Axeman. Hi, strangers. This is your host, Alexa Morrissey, and today we have a story that feels more like an urban legend than a tale of vicious home invasions. But as we know, fact can be stranger than fiction, and this story is very true, and we'll show you how one man controlled an entire city with fear. Lock your doors and listen closely. This is Stranger in the House. New Orleans has always been a truly unique city, but in the early 1900s, it changed in a drastic way that set it apart from other cities across America. After the Civil War, plantations across the South were broken up, and thousands of African Americans poured into New Orleans. This new demographic mixed with the Creole, white, and Jewish population to create a distinctly diverse and lively culture. And a new type of music was created to reflect that multicultural experience: jazz. Now, while this paints a fun and eccentric picture of a flourishing city, there was, unsurprisingly, a lot of social turmoil going on at the time. In addition to the influx of African Americans, there was also a lot of Italian immigrants coming in from Sicily during this time period. New Orleans was familiar with Italian immigrants, but most of them had come from northern Italy. Because of their darker skin, these Sicilian immigrants didn't fit into New Orleans' divisions of white and black. These Sicilian immigrants were willing to take over jobs on some of the plantations that former slaves were forced to do, and the white population refused to take on. This led to these Italian immigrants doing quite well financially. And while they were able to acquire a good amount of wealth from these jobs, it led to racial discrimination, and the people who identified as more white thought the Sicilians were no better than African Americans or other non-white immigrants. Despite the ethnic prejudice that they faced, these new Italian immigrants were able to save up their money, and by the 1910s, Italian-owned shops had sprung up all over Louisiana. Italian grocery stores were especially prevalent in New Orleans. Joseph Maggio was one of those Italian grocers. He and his wife Catherine ran a grocery store and a bar room out of the building they lived in. Joseph's brothers, Andrew and Jake, also lived in the adjacent apartment above the business. Andrew ran a barbershop not too far from the house, and the family was known as fairly successful in the area. During the early morning hours of May 23rd, 1918, Andrew Maggio was awoken by a muffled groaning noise coming through the wall he shared with his brother Joseph's apartment. When Andrew entered his brother's apartment to go check on him, he was faced with a gruesome sight. Lying in their bed, Joseph and his wife Catherine were covered in blood. Catherine was unmoving, clearly deceased. Her head had been bashed in, and her throat was sliced open. Joseph was in a similar state, but he seemed to still be alive. Barely. Andrew and his brother Jake called for the police, and minutes later, Joseph was dead. When police arrived to the scene, they determined that Joseph and Catherine had both had their throats slit with a razor first, and then their heads were smashed in with an axe. While Joseph was able to survive for about an hour after the attack, Catherine's throat had been slit so deeply that she was nearly decapitated. Nothing was taken from the house, and there were valuables and money laid out in plain sight, so police quickly ruled out robbery as a motive. While nothing was missing, strangely, something was added. Police found bloody clothes on the floor of the apartment, and with Joseph and Catherine still fully dressed, this suggested that the attacker changed into a clean set after the murders. A bloodied axe was found in the bathroom of the apartment, and it turned out it actually belonged to Joseph. A straight razor was found in a neighbor's yard, and it belonged to Joseph's brother, Andrew, which immediately made Andrew the prime suspect. According to one of Andrew's employees at the barbershop, Andrew took the razor from his shop 2 days prior, explaining that he had wanted to have a nick honed from the blade. Police also found it suspicious that Andrew had woken up from his brother's groaning, but not from any noises during the attack. Andrew admitted that he had drank heavily that evening, as he was celebrating his upcoming deployment with the Navy, and was in a heavy sleep for most of the night. Despite the police's suspicions, Andrew's story held up, and their attentions quickly turned to a mysterious man who had been spotted lurking around the neighborhood the night of the murders. An unknown man had been seen near the crime scene by several neighbors. While he was labeled as acting suspicious, no one had gotten a good look at his face. This wasn't the first time an axe murder had taken place in New Orleans. And it wasn't even the first time an Italian grocer had been murdered with an axe. And on the sidewalk near the crime scene was a message written in chalk reminding the city of that fact. On the sidewalk, police found the following message. Mrs. Maggio will sit up tonight, just like Mrs. Tony. Police believe this was a reference to Tony Sciambra, an Italian grocer who was murdered in his home with an axe in 1911. The Sciambras were killed by an unknown axe-wielding man who had entered their home by knocking out a panel on their back door. Now, there were several mysterious axe murders between 1911 and 1912, and many thought that this could be the same killer starting up again. While the message on the sidewalk was ominous, there was no way to know if the Maggio's killer had actually written it. On June 27th, 1918, a little over a month after Joseph and Catherine were murdered, another couple was attacked. Louis Bessemer, an Italian grocer who was soundly sleeping with his mistress, Harriet Anna Lowe, in the back quarters of his grocery store, when suddenly they were attacked with an axe. The two were found around 7 a.m. that morning by a baker who was making a delivery to the grocery store. He found the couple in a pool of blood, both bleeding from their heads. While Harriet was unconscious, she and Louis were miraculously alive. Police found a bloodied axe in the bathroom, and once again, it belonged to the grocer. While nothing was taken, police did find signs of forced entry. It was clear that the intruder had knocked out a panel on the back door and entered that way. Harriet was in and out of consciousness in the days following the attack, but Louis was able to tell police that he had been attacked in his sleep, but didn't get a good look at his attacker. Police arrested potential suspect Louis Obicon, a 41-year-old African-American man who had been employed by the Bessemer store just a week before the attacks. Police stated that Obicon had offered conflicting accounts of his whereabouts on the morning of the attack. But the arrest was obviously racially motivated, and there was no evidence that could link him to the attacks, and eventually he was released. One might think that the media would find two attacks on Italian grocers within a month of each other a story worth sharing. The attacks were overshadowed by the scandalous fact that Louis was found with his mistress, not his wife. Harriet ended up dying from her injuries 7 weeks after the attack. But before she passed, she offered the police an interesting piece of information. She said her attacker was a large, white male. On the night of August 5th, another attack occurred. This time, however, it wasn't the usual victim. 28-year-old Anna Schneider was 8 months pregnant and sleeping alone in her bed when suddenly she woke up to a dark figure looming over her. Once she woke, she was repeatedly hit in the head with an axe. Her scalp was cut open and some teeth were knocked out, but when her husband arrived around midnight, she was alive, despite being covered in blood. Anna claimed that she remembered nothing of her attacker, except for seeing an axe when she woke up. Miraculously, she gave birth to a healthy baby girl 2 days after the incident. Her husband told police that nothing was stolen from the house besides $6 or $7 that had been in his wallet. The windows and doors of the apartment appeared to have not been forced open. Despite Anna not being an Italian grocer, police began to suspect all these nighttime home invasions were connected. 5 days later, another Italian grocer was attacked. At 3 a.m., sisters Pauline and Mary Bruno heard noises coming from their uncle Joseph Romano's room. When they entered his bedroom, they saw their uncle laying on the floor with a serious blow to his head. According to the sisters, the attacker was fleeing the house through the back door as they made their way to their uncle's room. They said the man was dark-skinned, heavy-set, and wore a suit and a slouched hat. Police found a bloodied axe in the backyard, and once again, a panel on the back door had been removed. The house appeared ransacked, but nothing had been taken. Joseph Romano initially survived his attack, but died 3 days later in the hospital from his injuries. The day after Romano's attack, Al Durand, who lived 10 blocks from Romano, went to his backyard and saw a large hatchet, a screwdriver, and a .38 caliber cartridge on the ground. He then looked down at his door, and he saw scratches from either a screwdriver or a chisel, as if there had been an attempt to remove a panel. When Durand called the police, they were sure that this was the same man trying to get into another home. It was at this point that New Orleans erupted in chaos, which was only heightened by the media frenzy surrounding the cases. The local newspapers began to call the killer the Axeman, an ominous title that gave the villain an almost supernatural aura. Everyone was terrified of the Axeman. And while most victims were Italian grocers, Anna Schneider's attack proved that anyone could be next. The New Orleans Item reported that many people were no longer sleeping at night, locking their doors and arming themselves in case the murderer came to their home. With everyone too frightened to sleep, the paper wrote, "Night had turned into day for many New Orleanians." The Times-Picayune interviewed John D'Antonio, a then-retired detective, who described the potential killer as an individual of dual personalities who killed without motive. This type of individual, D'Antonio stated, would very likely be a normal, law-abiding citizen who was often overcome by an overwhelming desire to kill. He later went on to describe the killer as a real-life Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. With the city on edge, all eyes were on the lookout for the Axeman. Police received dozens of reports in which citizens claimed to have seen the Axeman lurking in their neighborhoods. When one citizen yelled out that she had seen the Axeman, 40 police officers at the scene were quickly outnumbered by the 300 armed vigilantes that showed up. Despite their numbers, the Axeman was not caught by the mob, but many thought that the crowd had spooked him enough to make him hide, because there were no reported attacks in the following months. But the fear of being caught didn't deter him for long, because 7 months later, on March 10th, 1919, the Axeman was back. Only this time, he had crossed the Mississippi River to the New Orleans suburb, Gretna. That night, 69-year-old Lorlando Giordano heard screams coming from his neighbor's home across the street. When he arrived, he found Italian grocer Charles Cortimiglia and his wife, Rosie, alive but severely injured. Even worse, Rosie was holding her dead 2-year-old daughter, Mary, in her arms. According to Rosie, she was sleeping with Mary on her chest when she awoke to find her husband fighting off an unknown intruder. During this fight, Charles took several blows to the head via an axe, which resulted in a fractured skull. Once Charles was down, the Axeman turned his attention to Rosie and her baby. With one blow, the Axeman fractured Rosie's skull and killed the 2-year-old instantly. Charles and Rosie were rushed to the hospital while police investigated the scene. Again, nothing valuable was taken from the house, but there was a panel removed from the back door and a bloodied axe found resting on the back porch. The Axeman had a total of 8 victims at this point, and the police were no closer to catching him than they were after his first victim. 3 days after the attacks on the Cortimiglias, on March 13th, a letter was sent to the Times-Picayune. The letter's header said it was sent from hell, and it was addressed to esteemed mortal. As the reporters at the Times read it, they quickly realized that they had just received a letter from the alleged Axeman of New Orleans and published it for the whole city to read on March 14th, 1919. While I won't read the whole letter, many of the statements this supposed Axeman makes are bone-chilling. His introduction describes himself as a demon from the hottest hell who had a close relationship with the Angel of Death. He brags that he could kill thousands more if he wanted to, and taunts the police, saying that he will never be caught, as he is not a human being. He then goes on to threaten the citizens of New Orleans, and offers a bizarre deal in exchange for their safety. Now, to be exact, at 12:15 earthly time, on next Tuesday night, I'm going to pass over New Orleans. In my infinite mercy, I'm going to make a little proposition to you people. Here it is. I am very fond of jazz music, and I swear by all the devils in the nether regions that every person shall be spared whose home a jazz band is in full swing at the time. If everyone has a jazz band going, well then, so much better for you people. One thing is certain, and that is that some of your people who do not play jazz on that specific Tuesday night, if there be any, will get the axe. While there was no way to confirm that the real murderer had written this letter, on that following Tuesday night, New Orleans erupted in jazz music. Every venue and dance hall available had a jazz band booked. People threw house parties with bands playing loud enough for the whole street to hear. Composer Joseph Davila created a song for the night called The Mysterious Axeman's Jazz, and it went on to be extremely popular. The city of New Orleans played jazz until the early hours of the morning to ward off the Axeman. And surprisingly enough, it worked. There were no murders committed that night. In fact, the jazz seemed to satisfy the Axeman for a while, because the rest of spring and most of summer would pass before he struck again. On August 10th, another Italian grocer, Stephen Bocca, was attacked. Bocca said that he was sleeping when he awoke to find a dark figure standing over him, who then struck him over the head. Bocca regained consciousness and found his head to be bleeding and cracked open. Nothing had been taken from the house, and a panel of the back door was removed. A month later, a young woman named Sarah Lawnman was attacked in a similar manner, in her bed with an axe. She survived and confirmed that nothing had been taken from the house. A bloody axe was found on her front lawn. The Axeman's reign of terror seemed as though it would never end, and the citizens of New Orleans wondered if they'd ever feel safe again. But on October 27th, 1919, these attacks would come to a gruesome conclusion. At 1 a.m. on October 27th, Esther Pepitone woke up to a noise coming from her husband Mike's bedroom. As she went to check on him, she saw two men fleeing out the front door. One was carrying an axe. When she entered her husband's room, she found him unconscious and covered in blood. According to police, Mike had sustained 18 blows to the head. The Times-Picayune reported that it was battered to an almost unrecognizable mass. Mike was rushed to the hospital, but declared dead within 2 hours. Mike Pepitone was an Italian grocer and father of six. Esther and Mike were not asleep in the same bed at the time of Mike's attack, which is why Esther survived that night. The intruders had entered through a window, which was different from the other crimes. Esther claimed that she saw two intruders, not one, but it was dark and she couldn't see any distinguishing features of the men. Once again, the attacker, or attackers, didn't take any valuables or any of the cash that was lying around the house. And just like that, the Axeman's murder spree ended as abruptly as it began. To this day, the Axeman has never been identified. An unsatisfying ending, isn't it? Well, what if I told you that while no one has ever officially been charged with these attacks, some scholars believe they have identified a suspect, and that suspect was actually murdered by a victim's widow. According to an article in the On the Spot Journal by Richard Warner and a few other sources, the Axeman may have been linked to the Italian Mafia. New Orleans has one of the oldest recorded mafia families in the United States, dating back to at least the 1870s. During the early 20th century, the Italian Mafia in both New York and New Orleans allegedly used grocery stores as fronts for rackets and extortion. According to Warner, the attacks on all the Italian grocers that were attributed to the Axeman of New Orleans were actually hits made by the Mafia. While this would be one explanation as to why Italian grocers made up the majority of the victims, there is another piece of the story that seems to support this theory. After the murder of her husband, Esther Pepitone, the widow of the Axeman's final victim, moved her and her children out to Los Angeles in the early 1920s. There, Esther remarried a man named Angelo Albano, who she had met back in New Orleans. What seemed like a fresh start for the family took a shocking turn in December of 1921, when Esther was arrested for shooting a man in her front yard. There isn't a lot of solid information on Esther's victim, but the man's name is generally given as Joseph Mumphrey. And it's possible that it was an alias for a man named Frank Doc Mumphrey. Mumphrey was a pharmacist in San Bernardino, California, but was also originally from New Orleans and was said to be involved with the New Orleans Mafia. Oddly enough, in 1908, he had been arrested for planting a bomb in a grocery store after he tried to extort money from the owner. Mumphrey actually knew Esther because he had been working with her new husband Angelo prior to their wedding. But Angelo allegedly dissolved their business partnership before the marriage. According to Esther, in October of 1921, Angelo went to the store to buy some vegetables for dinner, but then he disappeared and was never seen again. Esther filed a police report and went to Mumphrey to see if he knew anything or anywhere Angelo could be. According to Esther, Mumphrey suggested that Angelo was probably being held hostage and someone was going to ask for money from her soon. That someone was Mumphrey himself. Because on December 5th, Mumphrey went to Esther's home demanding money from her. When Esther refused, he told her that he would kill her like he killed Angelo. Pretending like she was going to get money and jewelry, Esther quickly grabbed a gun and shot Mumphrey. Mumphrey was allegedly hit with 8 bullets. While Esther was arrested, she was eventually acquitted, citing self-defense. But one of the strangest things to come out of her account of the night was that she said she recognized Mumphrey from her first husband's murder. a murder allegedly perpetrated by the mysterious Axeman of New Orleans. If you remember, after her first husband's murder, Esther told police that she saw two figures fleeing her home that night, but couldn't see any distinguishing features. But maybe, if it was in fact a hit by the mafia, she was too scared to say who she really saw that night. Or perhaps this is just a story a grieving woman made up to deal with what she did, putting the blame of both her husband's murders on the one man she killed. But there are a lot of undeniable coincidences. Mumphrey was from New Orleans and was known to be involved with the mafia, and would have been in the city during the Axeman murders. Mumphrey had actually been living in New Orleans back in 1911, when the first Axe murders occurred. Remember the chalk message, "Mrs. Maggio will sit up tonight like Mrs. Tony," how it was a reference to Tony Sciambra, an Italian grocer who was murdered in his home with an axe in 1911? Well, Mumphrey was allegedly questioned during that first murder investigation. In that same year, he was sent to prison on an extortion charge, and the murders immediately stopped afterwards. It was only after he was paroled in 1918 that the Axeman murders began again. And right after Mike Pepitone's death, the final Axeman murder, Mumphrey left New Orleans and moved to California, where he eventually met his end by the hands of Esther, the widow of the Axeman's final victim. Esther and her children moved back to New Orleans after she was acquitted, and to this day, the Axeman lives on through New Orleans local lore and pop culture. We will probably never know if Mumphrey was the actual Axeman, but if it wasn't Mumphrey or the Mafia, why were these people killed? Why were so many Italian grocers? Did the attacks have something to do with the racial prejudices and anger the Sicilian community was facing at the time? And the even bigger question, what did jazz have to do with all of this? Was the Axeman just the biggest jazz fan of all time? Was the letter a way to prove that he could control an entire city by making them do what he wanted? Was the letter even written by the actual Axeman, as some scholars believe it was not? We will never know. But what we do know is that for several years, New Orleans lived in fear of an axe-wielding stranger entering their homes. But for one night, they were kept safe by jazz. Stay safe, strangers, and thanks for listening. This episode was written by Alexa Morrissey, researched by Victoria Cox, and produced by Michael Morrissey, John Scassia, and Heidi Sherriman. Stranger in the House is a Boy Wonder production. You can follow us at strangerinthehouse.com, @_strangerinthehouse on Instagram and TikTok, and @_strangerpod on Twitter. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.